Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. 女士们、先生们，国际证监会组织第37届年会公开论坛的议题一，后金融危机时代新金融体系与国际准则的构建与完善即将开始。The theme of panel one is new financial architecture and international standards setting in the post-crisis era. Please welcome the moderator of this panel, Ms. Maria Helena Santana,Chair of the IOSCO Executive Committee and the speakers. 请大家用热烈的掌声欢迎六位嘉宾。
Thank you very much. So, good afternoon again. We have now the start of our conference, and I have the pleasure of chairing this panel.The theme of the panel is new financial architecture and international standard setting in the post-crisis era. I guess we all agree that we need sound policies, we need good regulation to correct the problems we've seen to prevent the recurrence of problems that we have already faced, to close gaps, to avoidroom for regulatory arbitrage, and for that, international consistency and convergence are a must. We have here in this panel some of the most important players in this game. We have, let me start by introducing Masamichi Kono, Vice Commissioner for International Affairs of the Financial Services Agency of Japan and Chairman of the IOSCO Technical Committee. And then we will have Elise Walter, Commissioner of the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission of the United States. She used to be, prior to being a regulator, she used to be a self-regulator as myself.Worked for FINRA and NASD. Then Michel Prada, who is now chairman of the IFRS Foundation Board of Trustees and is an old friend of IOSCO, well known to many of us, used to be chair of the AMF. He has chaired before IOSCO's Executive Committee, Technical Committee. He's an old friend.And we are very glad to have him here. And then Stephen Mayor, the first chair of the European Securities Market Authority, recently established, formerly managing director at the Dutch Financial Authority, AFM. And Mr. Xu Qing, whom you all know, the chairman of the CSRC,who also has a large career in the public sector here in China, including as former deputy governor of the China Central Bank. So with this brief introduction, I want to give the floor to Masa, please. Our intention is to have a 15-minute speech by our panelists, and unfortunately we won't have time for Q&A in this panel. Please, Masa.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And since I have to move my slides, if I may move over. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My great honor, of course, to be speaking in this panel. And I must say, I may not be the appropriate person to speak first, because I will not be talking about... my design of the new financial architecture, but rather I will be spending some time on a discussion of the way global regulators are now conducting those reform efforts, whether that structure or framework of standard setting and discussion are really appropriate and fit for the times.Now, this is a question to you, and we would like, of course, if possible, some input from the people in the room. We may not have enough time for discussion, but at least for your thoughts, because this is really an overarching issue, and it has increasingly become so very recently because, of course, of the intractable problem of cross-sectoral issues, of all the issues of regulatory arbitrage, of level playing field, proliferating and various business structures, and, of course, the way financial institutions are developing through mergers, acquisitions, and also spin-offs, etc. Now, so in this first slide I have here, excuse me. Yeah, yes. So those are the questions that I would really like to ask in this at the outset. That is, are we really coping with the increasingly cross-sectoral issues in a proper manner? Are we able to address those issues appropriately using our existing structure? Is there enough cooperation and coordination among different regulators and supervisors? And I'm afraid this has really been the focus of a lot of news articles, a lot of editorials, and of course there have been very strong criticism from various quarters about the uncoordinated way in the manner the reform efforts have been taken forward, the existing or perceived inconsistencies that appear to be arising or surfacing from those reform efforts. So, in fact, I must say we are far from, of course, perfect. Now, during the past year, as the chair of the technical committee of AERSCO, I have spent a lot of time really in actually coordinating with the G20 FSB and with the other standard setters. Here I have this chart with the Basel Committee and IIS along with AERSCO. Now, the FSB plays a coordination role in addressing cross-sectoral regulatory issues in cooperation with each SSB, SSB meaning the standard setting body. Well, it's easier said than done, of course, and of course there is a need for each standard setter to keep its independence, its own agenda. Also, the membership of each standard setter would differ by very much, and AERSCO it has certainly a very broad membership. So therefore, we cannot say that AERSCO or, in fact, any of the standard setters are subsidiary bodies or subordinate to the FSB, but still, we cannot just assert that without coordinating, without avoiding conflicts, without avoiding creating gaps. Now, just to take some examples of areas in which we do need very close cooperation, very close coordination in the designing of the rules. So, like systemic risk in the non-bank sector I put here, but in fact, this is in the context of systemically important financial institutions, what we now call, with the strange name of SIFIs. You can't really just talk about market regulation or the regulation of market intermediaries when dealing with those SIFIs. Those giant global financial institutions, or even the smaller ones who have really a lot of impact on the financial system at large when it suddenly fails or when there is difficulty. And in fact, we have such a term as interconnectedness. And if, as a result of financial liberalization, of development of new technologies, globalization, all our financial institutions, even the smaller ones, are very much interconnected with other institutions. And other institutions are, of course, not just the same types of institutions, but different types of institutions. And so, certainly, so far as IOSCO is concerned, systemic risk in the non-bank sector has to be dealt with, but those are also linked very closely to banks, to insurance companies, to other entities and markets, and this is really cross-sectoral. Shadow banking, again, that overlaps a bit with this issue of systemically important financial institutions, but here we treat such subjects as money market funds, hedge funds, investment managers, repos, securities lending, and the whole process of securitization. Those are all important subjects treated under the shadow banking work streams of the FSB. But for IOSCO, let's say we cannot deal with this without coordinating, without cooperating with other standard setters and with the FSB and then up to the G20. OTC derivatives, another example where, of course, there is really, excuse me, a lot of risk that can rise from financial market infrastructures. And, of course, as you all well know, this market or those markets are not just the monopoly of swap dealers or market intermediaries, banks, insurance companies, pension funds. They're all participants in those markets. Now, of course, IOSCO has been trying to cope with this with the development of, for example, various principles and standards which pertain to those areas in which IOSCO has expertise and also where IOSCO is really relevant and playing an important role. And of course, earlier there has been a mention from our executive committee chair and from the secretary general about the MMOU, which is really indispensable and extremely effective tool to deal with enforcement issues amongst IOSCO members. But let's say, increasingly, those will not be entirely enough to deal with the various cross-sectoral issues. Now, I have here something on from now on, certain roles that IOSCO should be playing in this increasingly intertwined global regulatory setting, and not just, of course, with regard to its standard setting role, but also in what I would call a policy dialogue role. And IOSCO needs to be forward-looking. It has to increase its presence at the G20 and FSB and to enhance policy discussions because, as I mentioned, the story does not end at IOSCO, but it has to also sometimes start at IOSCO, and we have to have this involvement, its capacity to set the agenda for global regulatory reform. And so we have to interact even more actively with the G20 and the FSB. Now, here, in the next arrow, under the next arrow, there is something reference to securing market integrity and efficiency, as well as enhancing investor protection and utility. Well, that is also really in the recognition that markets really link the various sectors and the various players, and therefore, what we should be looking at will not just be the relevant entities and also investor protection in the traditional sense, but a more bird's eye view of the markets and then identification of emerging risks, that would really be something that we do need to be better doing. And then effectively contribute to simultaneously achieving stability and efficiency in the entire financial system, and disseminating forward-looking views and thus enhancing its global presence. Now, in order to achieve this, we have already decided to put an emphasis on the research capabilities at the Secretariat as well as across the membership. IOSCO needs to be open, well, of course, market regulators always been at the forefront of this emphasis on transparency and disclosure, but then it has to be open also to a wide range of members, take into account the different needs of members, and strengthen effective communication. I think we have not been entirely successful in our press communication strategies, our outreaches. I think we need to put more emphasis on that. Now, excuse me. Prioritization is also necessary. I think at last count, IOSCO was undertaking something like 43 projects at the same time. This sounds too much, but let's say if we put this into context, if we put this into a real strategy with priorities attached, we can be effective. We can be also relevant to the global policy dialogue. That is something that we would like to achieve. And finally, inclusive IOSCO. This has been mentioned by our emerging market colleagues in particular, but from the non-emerging markets, if I may put it that way, we know that the solutions can no longer come just from a handful of countries. We need to put together all our minds, all our expertise to deal with a global problem. And it is really a whole set of imbalances that have been created over the years. But at the same time, in many cases, actually, there must be a win-win solution to those issues that are of interest to everybody. We would not like to take a view where there is a certain conflict between two worlds, developed and developing. I don't think that really captures the reality of the globalized capital markets anymore. So we have to be inclusive, inclusive meaning to, of course, engage our emerging market partners and the emerging market authorities in the policymaking work, provide technical assistance and investor protection education through this IOSCO Foundation that we have decided to start working on, and ensure involvement of relevant securities derivatives regulators with substantial power and influence in respective markets to effectively promote globally coordinated regulatory initiatives. Yes, but at the bottom of all this, or as an overarching theme, we want really to have IOSCO as a well-governed, democratic organization, and inclusive in that sense would also mean that there will be no classification of members developed or developing, but rather a truly global framework for cooperation and coordination. So I'm quite sure that you may have some reservations or objections to what I've mentioned. I would certainly like to hear some from our colleagues on the panel. I don't want to take up more of your time since we are already past perhaps our deadline, but thank you very much for your attention and look forward to further discussion.
Thank you very much, Masa, for the comprehensive overview on IOSCO's technical work. And I give now the floor to Elise Walter, please.
Thank you, Maria Elena. Like others before me, I'd like to start by offering my thanks and those of my colleagues at the USSEC to Chairman Guo and the staff of the CSRC for hosting such an extraordinary event. We have many critical global issues on the agenda, and I know that your hospitality, and particularly the exceptional music we heard last night, have honed the ability of all of us here to focus on our mission and to redouble our efforts to reach answers to the thorny questions before us, so I thank you. I'd also like to thank Maria Elena for her exemplary leadership of the IOSCO Executive Committee and her steadfastness and integrity. And to the IOSCO Secretariat, my thanks as well, both for your work in making this conference happen and for everything you do on a daily basis to advance the cooperation, coordination, and cohesion IOSCO is intended to further. As most of you know, our chairman, Mary Shapiro, was slated to be with you today. She has asked me to send her heartfelt apologies for the fact that serious domestic business required her to stay at home because she simply couldn't be out of touch for the hours of flying time necessary to reach this beautiful and historic city. But I am extremely pleased to be able to stand in for her today and to deliver her remarks. My thanks go to the CSRC for asking me to substitute for our irreplaceable chairman. While, as SEC policy demands, I ask that everyone note that my remarks today represent my own views and do not necessarily reflect the views of other commissioners or the commission itself, I do plan to give my best to give my voice to the sentiments of Chairman Shapiro, which I wholeheartedly share. This panel is entitled New Financial Architecture, and one of the points to be discussed is the importance of cross-border enforcement cooperation, and I want to emphasize the word enforcement, and to consider that particularly in light of the recent financial crisis. That is the concept to which I'd like to direct my remarks. However, in doing so, I want to suggest a change because enforcement cooperation is only part of the cooperation across borders that is critical to the new financial architecture. Enforcement cooperation was a necessary first step, but now we have to prepare ourselves for the next crucial step, supervisory cooperation. The past 30 years have taught the world of financial regulators several things. First, for a market to grow, it must have interconnections, and I think that will be the word of the day. To trade, you must have trading partners. To have a financial market, you need connections among market participants, investors, issuers, market intermediaries, and other market actors. This is a timeless truth, and the pace of market interconnection appears to be accelerating, whether we are in a period of boom or a period of crisis. A second thing we have learned over the past several years is that in a global marketplace, financial problems that arise in one jurisdiction often do not stop at national borders. Instead, they spill over those borders into other countries and travel the globe. But those borders still constrain a national regulator's powers. Therefore, without assistance, a single regulator may not be able to collect evidence or recover assets for investors when people who commit fraud are located abroad. Similarly, on the supervisory side of what we do, without help, a regulator cannot conduct an examination to verify that a regulated entity located abroad is in compliance with the rules it is required to follow. Yet the existence of national sovereignty does not mean that we can be blind to the growing globalization of our markets. As regulators with mandates from our legislatures, we cannot ignore what happens within our borders. We cannot ignore the activities of issuers and firms abroad that affect our own markets. Given the limits placed on action by national regulators beyond their borders and our obligations to oversee our domestic markets, there are two possible ways to meet the threat of cross-border fraud and other misconduct. The first is to build a moat around one's economy. Capital controls, barriers to entry, and other devices to shield a financial market from the rest of the world. At first blush, this may seem an attractive option. Many of the economies that avoided the worst of the recent financial crisis had capital controls and other barriers between their markets and the rest of the world. But there is a high cost to such isolationism, and no market is completely impermeable. A financial market that does not participate in the wider global market limits the types of interconnections that generate market growth. Such a market is making a trade-off, sacrificing potentially greater growth for the protection that comes from severing ties with the larger global marketplace. A second option, and the better alternative, because it preserves growth and recognizes the inevitable ties between markets, and yet still offers a degree of protection against cross-border risks to the financial system, is closer ties among market regulators to keep better pace with growing market connections. Securities regulators have long recognized the importance of maintaining the transparency and integrity of securities markets. But market transparency and integrity require more than just good laws and regulation. The highest quality accounting and auditing standards and the most comprehensive anti-fraud laws are meaningless if those standards and laws are not enforced. These standards statements are self-evident today, but this wasn't always the case. Until the 1980s, many jurisdictions did not ban insider trading. Even where statutes regarding market fraud existed, many securities regulators lacked the legal authority to properly investigate and prosecute such fraud. And even when regulators did share information, limitations on the use of that information prevented them from further sharing the information with criminal authorities. The result was that even where a regulator had the authority to investigate and take action against fraud, the trail very quickly became cold once it crossed a jurisdiction's borders. But fortunately, today, laws and regulations have changed. All IOSCO jurisdictions recognize that their securities regulators should have comprehensive inspection, investigative, surveillance, and enforcement powers. Every IOSCO member recognizes that securities regulators should have the authority to share information with their foreign counterparts. And finally, we all recognize that we should have the power to conduct investigations on behalf of one another. These regulator-to-regulator alliances have significantly enhanced all of our abilities to deter, detect, and punish fraud and other abuses in our markets. But as the events over the past few years have amply demonstrated, enforcement cooperation of the type that IOSCO has advanced so well is only the first step in protecting the integrity of our globalized markets. Enforcement cooperation is ad hoc and after the fact. It kicks in after something has already gone wrong. What our markets and investors demand is a second step, enhanced regulatory oversight, and much closer supervisory cooperation among regulators in relation to large cross-border market actors. Only that type of cooperation can prevent the harm from taking place. Some have interpreted this demand as a call for a transnational regulatory body or a harmonization of regulatory policy and philosophy. But this view misses a fundamental truth. We can form transnational coordination bodies, and we have, such as the FSB and the G20, and we can help develop international standards through bodies such as IOSCO. But we all know that at the end of the day, it is domestic governments and their regulators that are responsible for administration and enforcement of the law. Yet, and this is critical, regulators must be able to work together closely across borders, not only to share enforcement-related information, but also to facilitate each other's oversight of regulated entities that are operating in multiple jurisdictions. we need to recognize that given the interconnections among markets, a threat to our counterparts' market is very much a threat to our own. To do this, securities regulators must put aside the obsolete view of regulatory sovereignty that focuses exclusively on borders. The United States is committed to open capital markets, but open capital markets are difficult to keep open without the assistance of regulators in other markets. We have seen what financial contagion looks like and the risks to our market as a result of the activities of globally active firms are great. Because of this, U.S. regulators are subject to legislative mandates that we oversee entities operating in our market, even if they are based abroad. Those risks and that mandate mean that we cannot ignore situations in which we are unable to get critical information that happens to be located abroad. It also means that we need to rethink traditional notions of regulatory sovereignty. The idea that foreign regulators might wish to visit the U.S. offices of a firm they regulate does not offend me. To the contrary, I welcome it. It means those regulators are doing their jobs, and that in turn means that the U.S. market is less likely to face a risk from a regulatory problem abroad. After all, the entities those foreign regulators are inspecting have chosen to operate abroad and chosen to be subject to overseas registration requirements. For the same reason, if those regulators need our help in accessing supervisory or enforcement information located in the United States, we are very happy to provide our assistance. If we have learned anything, it is that a threat to their markets could well be a threat to ours. I believe that we are making great strides towards creating a regulatory regime in which jurisdictions work closely with one another to diminish the possibility of cross-border harm. The SEC currently has enforcement information sharing arrangements with more than 80 other jurisdictions, either bilaterally or through the IOSCO multilateral MOU. We continue to refine and make these alliances stronger. We have also concluded supervisory cooperation arrangements with a number of regulators. All of these supervisory cooperation arrangements contemplate regular information sharing among supervisory staff at the SEC and its overseas counterparts, and all of them recognize both the importance of direct access to critical information from regulated entities and the need for on-site examinations. And of course, IOSCO itself has published principles regarding supervisory cooperation, which include a model MOU that IOSCO members can adapt for their use. Unfortunately, the implementation of supervisory and enforcement cooperation is not yet universal. That leaves regulators who oversee regulated entities with a cross-border presence with few options. We can ignore the overseas offices of regulated entities and hide our heads in the sand, but that would be irresponsible. We could close our market and insist that all regulated market participants operate exclusively in our own jurisdiction, guaranteeing that we have access to all relevant supervisory information and avoiding the thorny issues such as on-site examinations in other countries. But that would be severing our market from the broader global economy. Or we could be selective and close our market to market participants from those jurisdictions where supervisory and enforcement assistance is not forthcoming, while keeping it open for entities from those jurisdictions where information and assistance is more freely shared with us. This last scenario may be preferable to the first two, but it clearly is not optimal. It is flawed. It could easily result in two parallel marketplaces, one for nations able to cooperate and share information, and another for those whose regulators cannot. In that world, advanced integrated markets, which are overseen by a close network of regulators sharing information, would enjoy the efficiencies and growth offered by an international capital marketplace. At the same time, a second-tier market would develop, one in which investors would be taking their chances. Of course, there is another option, one I might label the best of all possible worlds. We could solidify our enforcement cooperation, expand our supervisory cooperation efforts, reject limiting views of regulatory sovereignty, and view supervisory and enforcement cooperation as a form of collective defense for securities regulators and markets. If we proceed in that fashion, we would connect regulators in an open and effective manner. In turn, this would support open, interconnected, and efficient markets of high integrity. I am optimistic that the work we are doing together and through IOSCO will lead us to achieve this much better solution. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you very much, Elise, for this, for calling our attention to this really huge challenge of cooperating after regulating. I would now like to give the floor to Michel Fada, please.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is indeed a great pleasure for me to participate in this IOSCO conference here in Beijing. And I'm grateful to IOSCO, Maria Elena Santana, and to the CSRC, Dr. Guo, for their kind invitation and for this opportunity to meet again with old friends. I am honored to appear in this panel among such distinguished company. Among the panelists, I should declare that my good friend Masako Ono serves as chairman of the IFRS Foundation Monitoring Board, which makes him my boss. So I must choose my words very carefully. For those of you who don't know me, I joined the Club of Securities Regulators in 1995. As chairman of the French COB and then AMF. And in my capacity of chairman, I chaired the executive technical committee of IOSCO, and I am still a strong supporter of this superb organization that has played a major role in the building of an international net framework for the regulation and supervision of global financial markets. I understand IOSCO has undertaken a major reform of its governance, and I congratulate you on this bold decision that will enhance both its visibility and its efficiency. Actually, this is the third time that I have returned to IOSCO. First of all, I served between 1995 and 2002. Then I returned in 2003 and left in 2008, and now here I am again. To me, IOSCO is a sort of Hotel California for securities regulators. You may check out, but you can never leave. Today, I'm speaking in my capacity of chairman of the Board of Trustees of the International Financial Reporting Standards Foundation, a position I have held since the beginning of this year as the successor to a well-known securities regulator and central banker, our good friend Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa, who passed away 15 months ago. During my brief opening remarks, I would like to make three points. First, that IOSCO is one of the founding fathers of the move towards global standards and should receive a great deal of the credit for what has been achieved. Second, that despite a decade of progress, the IFRS project is not yet complete. There remain many challenges ahead of us, and there is no room for complacency. Third, and this point is perhaps the most relevant to this audience, far from outsourcing the whole development of international accounting standards to the IASB, we need you to stay closely involved to help us overcome these challenges by being active participants throughout the life cycle of the standard setting process. We cannot do this alone on our own. Let's start with the good news. It is an often overlooked fact that the momentum behind global accounting standards began back in May 2000 at the Sydney Annual Conference of IOSCO. At that time, the members of IOSCO endorsed for cross-border listings the core standards of the IASB's predecessor body, the Part-Time International Accounting Standards Committee. That decision triggered a chain reaction of events that led to the restructuring of the IASC into the trustees of the IFRS Foundation and the IASB that we know today. These events took place for good reason. At that time, we were witnessing a substantial transition in capital formation. According to the United Nations, between 1970 and 2000, the world experienced a 50-fold increase in foreign direct investment. A national approach to financial reporting no longer seemed appropriate when counterparties on either side of a trade were sitting on different sides of the world. National rules acted as an impediment to the free flow of capital. They increased costs for multinational companies, and they created opportunities for regulatory arbitrage. The answer was, of course, to raise the bar internationally and to develop a single set of high quality and globally accepted accounting standards. And indeed, a visionary idea became a reality. In the last 10 years, we've gone from almost no economies using international accounting standards to a world where companies in more than 100 countries, to begin with the European Union members, are required or permitted to use IFRS. From this year, more than two-thirds of G20 countries are required to use IFRS. In the last 2 years alone, we've seen Brazil, Canada, Korea, Mexico, and Russia all require the use of IFRS in full and without modification. Almost half of global Fortune 500 companies now report using IFRS. Therefore, it is clear today that the IFRS Foundation fits the three main criteria that any international standard setter should meet. Technical credibility, due to the skills of our staff and board members. Political legitimacy, due to the oversight of the monitoring board. And accountability, due to the remarkable transparency, inclusive nature, and efficiency of our due process. While celebrating these achievements, we must also recognize that many challenges remain. Broadly speaking, we must do what we can to ensure that IFRS become global standards and that the IASB consolidate its role as the global accounting standard setter. Let's take the first point. I think we can safely say that IFRS have now achieved critical mass at international standards and are here to stay. However, we cannot get the full benefit of those standards without the remaining major economies coming fully on board. The financial crisis served to increase the urgency of this work. Policymakers around the world have asked for a level playing field in financial reporting. It is seen as an essential element of the global regulatory reform agenda, evidenced by the repeated G20 communiques that have supported the work of the IASB and called for a rapid transition towards global accounting standards. China has already substantially reformed its own financial reporting standards through a continuous convergence process, and the differences between those standards and IFRS are today very small. Japan already permits the use of IFRS for certain domestic companies, while India is determining its own IFRS strategy. Perhaps most eagerly anticipated decision is whether and how the United States will incorporate IFRS into its own financial reporting regime. The IASB and the FASB have spent 10 years since the Norwalk Agreement laying the groundwork for this decision through a dedicated and fruitful effort of convergence, and I look forward to a positive outcome to the SEC's deliberations on this important topic. Getting everyone on board with IFRS provides the baseline, but it is not the end of the story. The standards must be also endorsed, implemented, and enforced on a consistent basis. If investors have to worry about which dialect of IFRS jurisdictions has applied, then we will be heading back to the old days of national standards. This brings me on to the future role of the ASB as a global accounting standard setter. The trustees have recently completed a wide-reaching strategy review that considered the mission, governance, standard-setting process, and financing of the organization. At the same time, the IFRS Foundation Monitoring Board, to whom the trustees report, conducted its own independent review of institutional governance arrangement. Both reports were published jointly in February this year, and both reports are required reading for anyone with an interest in the future direction of financial reporting. The trustee strategy review makes a number of excellent recommendations. In my view, one of the most important, and the one which is most relevant to the topics that I have already covered, is the intention to formalize the IASB's relationship with others involved in the financial reporting supply chain, accounting standard setters, audit and securities regulators, and others. The purpose of this is twofold. The first relates to the IASB's ability to create standards that can be applied around the world and without modification. The IASB cannot do this alone. It must find ways to work in close cooperation with standard-setting bodies around the world, to tap into the best thinking in financial reporting, but also to make sure that jurisdictional requirements are fully taken into consideration. The second purpose is to improve consistency in the implementation of those standards. The IASB has been given the responsibility to develop international standards, but it doesn't have the authority to say how those standards should be endorsed, implemented, or enforced. Neither is it equipped to easily identify the consequences of the standards without the contribution of those entities that implement them in the field. The flexible nature of the IASB's working relationships with securities regulators and others continues to deliver substantial benefits. However, the strategy review concludes that a closer and more structured dialogue is required if the promise of global accounting standards is to be achieved. This is where IOSCO comes in. As I said at the beginning of my address, IOSCO can be thought as being one of the founding fathers of the move towards the global accounting standards. Securities regulators and accounting standard setters are natural allies. We may not always agree, but we both instinctively have investors' interests at heart. We should be sitting on the same side of the table. And by the way, it happens that both the chair of the trustees and the chair of the IASB, our good friend Hans Hogevorst, are very close to this organization where they worked together a few years ago. However, I get the impression that the relationship between the IASB and IOSCO is not as well developed as it could be. Maybe this in itself is not a problem. The trustees and the IASB have very healthy dialogue with regional authorities, such as the ESMA and national authorities, such as the SEC and indeed the CSRC and others. It is also true that IOSCO has two seats on the IFRS Advisory Council and observer status on the IFRS Interpretations Committee, and frequently submits comment letters in response to our proposals. But I cannot help but feel that deeper and more continuous international coordination is also required, and that is a role that only IOSCO can play. The trustee strategy review provides the framework for a more proactive relationship with IOSCO. There are many areas where enhanced cooperation with IOSCO would be mutually beneficial. For example, working jointly on the post-implementation reviews of major standards, providing more general feedback to the ISB project teams on how the standards are being implemented around the world. We need to find a right mechanism for our respective organizations to deepen cooperation. And this is something that Yael Almog, who many of you know well, will address in the coming months as our recently appointed Executive Director of the IFRS Foundation. To summarize these remarks, we have come a very long way since IOSCO met in Sydney in 2000 to endorse the core standards. Since then, progress has been truly remarkable, but the IFRS project remains work in progress. The people in this room have a clear interest in the success of this project, and I call upon you to re-engage with our work at the IOSCO level to ensure that the G20 goal of global accounting standards can be delivered. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Your message and request is duly noticed. We must discuss this, but I guess it makes all sense to enhance cooperation between our two organizations. You're right. Please, Stephen Mayor, take the floor.
Thank you very much, Maria Helena, for the introduction. And I think I need to queue up in a very long line of people who have congratulated the organizers, the Beijing organizers, the group of Chairman Guo, and the CSRC for organizing the event. It's been a very good days here in Beijing. I'm very much impressed by the warm hospitality and the smooth organization of the conference, and it's great that we all have the opportunity to be here a few days in the wonderful city of Beijing. And in addition, and probably even more importantly, holding the annual event here reflects the economic importance of China and I think Asia more generally for the current financial markets. However, before I go to the specific topics of this panel, let me first introduce ESMA. We're for the first time formally represented at an annual IOSCO meeting, and I feel obliged to briefly introduce the organization. ESMA's mission is to enhance the protection of investors and to promote stable and well-functioning financial markets in the European Union. As an independent institution, ESMA achieves this aim by building a single rulebook for EU financial markets and assuring its consistent application across the Union. ESMA contributes to the regulation of financial services firms with a pan-European reach, either through direct supervision or through the active coordination of national supervisory activity. In addition, of course, ESMA has a role regarding the consistent application of the single rulebook across the Union. To briefly illustrate some of our activities, we have already made technical standards regarding credit rating agencies, short selling, and now we're drafting the technical standards for OTC derivatives. In addition, CRAs are under our direct supervision, and we will participate in the supervisory colleges for CCPs. To achieve our mission, we extensively cooperate with the 27 national EU securities regulators who are all represented on the Board of Supervisors of ESMA. And the Board of Supervisors is the highest decision-making entity within ESMA, taking decisions on such issues as standards and guidelines. On the international side, we foster dialogue and cooperation with supervisors outside the EU. We are empowered to develop contacts and enter into administrative arrangements with the supervisory authorities and administrations of the so-called third countries, and with international organizations. For example, we are currently coordinating the negotiation of memoranda of understanding between the EU and non-EU authorities for the supervision of alternative investment fund managers that operate on a cross-border basis, and we have frequent bilateral and multilateral contacts relating to the regulation of OTC derivatives. Also, ESMA intends to become active within IOSCO in the fields of its direct competence. Let me conclude on this brief description by emphasizing that ESMA also has, in addition to the traditional objectives of transparency and investor protection, financial stability as an objective. This is consistent with the increased focus by securities markets regulators across the world on stability concerns in response to the financial crisis. Essential elements of achieving this objective are identifying stability risks and conducting stress tests of market players like CCPs. For us, probably like for other securities regulators, this is a relatively new area, and exchanging experiences with other securities regulators across the world would be highly beneficial. This exchange should not be limited to possible models, frameworks, and methodologies, but also the exchange of actual identified stability risks. It is difficult to think of stability risks that have no cross-border implication. IOSCO has started work on the stability objective, and I strongly support further work in this area. And I think it was also a point made very strongly by David Wright on the importance of identifying stability risks and starting an international dialogue on these risks across the world. Let me now move on to the subject matter of this panel. Why is it so important to aim for broadly common regulation of financial markets at worldwide level? In the middle of this ongoing financial crisis, it would be foolish not to support broadly common regulation of international financial markets. Still, I would like to give you my views on the main reasons for common regulation, as we need to continually keep them in mind when reforming international financial markets. First, many market participants, both on the investor side and the industry side, operate on a global level. Therefore, to achieve the same level of investor protection and to minimize the extra cost of doing business at the international level, common regulation is desirable. Second, financial markets are very sensitive and responsive to regulatory differences, and this holds especially for wholesale financial markets. Differences in regulation will affect where financial activities are conducted. And to avoid regulatory competition, where regions are undercutting each other with laxer and also more risky regulation, we need to cooperate to achieve the same level of robust regulation. Competition is the right model for markets. It's not the right model for regulation and supervision. Common regulation also increases the acceptance by the financial industry in our local markets of the far-reaching consequences of regulatory reforms. The additional costs of new regulations are more palatable when the industry knows that their international competitors are confronted with the same costs. I should also mention here that the committee that laid the foundations for the establishment of ESMA, the so-called De La Rogière Committee, considered regulatory competition to be one of the most important causes of this financial crisis. Third, the performance of financial markets in countries and regions across the world is strongly linked. No financial market can isolate itself from the performance of other markets across the world. Hence, the value of a well-regulated home market is constrained by the potential risks of less regulated markets abroad. Therefore, we all have a strong interest that not only our own financial market is well regulated, but also all other foreign markets to which the home market is exposed. This also goes back to my earlier point that we need to exchange information on stability risks. Let me now move on to how we can achieve broadly common regulation of financial markets across the world. That achieving this objective is difficult and hard work needs no further explanation at this event. IOSCO is the most experienced organization in this respect, and its members are well aware of all the difficulties involved in international cooperation, but also that in the end, we will be successful. I would like to comment on two specific issues relating to achieving broadly common regulation of international financial markets. The first issue concerns the regulation of internationally active market players by various national regulators. The second issue concerns the relationship between securities markets regulators and our governments who decide on the core regulation with which we have to work. When regulating national, or in the case of the EU, regional financial markets, the issue needs to be addressed of how international market players are regulated, and Elise Waller also extensively discussed this issue earlier in the panel. To illustrate this with the European perspective and also the European terminology, how do we, for example, regulate market players like CRAs, hedge funds, private equity firms, and CCPs from third countries doing business in the EU? to provide EU investors with the same level of protection and to create a level playing field with EU market players, these third country market players need to meet the same EU requirements. They need to live up to the same standards. This automatically raises the potential problem of market players becoming subject to multiple regulatory regimes. These potential problems can be controlled under two conditions. The first one is that the regulatory requirements of the third country and EU are broadly similar. More common regulations between home and host regulators obviously limit the potential problems facing cross-border entities and activities. I will discuss achieving broadly common regulation later in my contribution. Secondly, we must avoid circumstances where market players are subject to two or even more sets of day-to-day regulatory demands. In this context, I believe that the easiest and most efficient option is a system based on equivalence and relying on mutual recognition. Without mutual recognition, entities operating on a cross-border basis would be subject to different requirements and to the jurisdiction of different authorities. This exposes them to potentially conflicting requirements and to higher compliance costs. Of course, before you rely on a foreign regulatory system, its robustness needs to be assessed. Hence, the equivalence needs to be assessed of the home country regulation and supervision of the foreign market player. However, when the home country regulation and supervision achieve similar outcomes, we will need to rely on mutual recognition and cooperation with the home country regulator. This cooperation, the last cooperation with the home country regulator, is essential to ensure that when needed and in response to specific risks, you can supervise the third country market participant in the same way as domestic participants. Let me now move on to the topic of governments and securities regulators. Much of the regulation with which we have to work as securities regulators depends on decisions by our governments. And as we are all aware, there is no governance mechanism at worldwide level which ensures that governments take coordinated decisions regarding the regulation of financial markets. The EU has developed such a mechanism after many decades. The European Commission, the Council, and the EU Parliament can decide on directives and regulation, and ESMA can decide and have the powers to write technical standards. While we should obviously respect the sovereignty of governments, I have already made clear what the benefits are of broadly common regulation of international financial markets. Not achieving broadly common regulation will inevitably lead to different levels of investor protection, as well as an uneven playing field and extra cost for market players. Hence, sovereign governments can obviously deviate locally, but these deviations come at a high price. I should now qualify my statement that there is no governance mechanism at worldwide level ensuring that governments take coordinated action regarding financial market regulation. And of course, it's been mentioned earlier in the panel, is the G20 commitments and system. One of the few positive results of the financial crisis is the G20 commitments on financial market reform and the new role of the Financial Stability Board. As a result of these G20 commitments, the regulatory developments in the main financial centers of the world are broadly similar on such issues as CRAs, hedge funds, and OTC derivatives. Of course, it goes much further and also into the banking area with agreements on bank capital, the accounting issue that was mentioned earlier, and also remuneration in the financial sector. As a result of these G20 commitments, we all know the complaints by industry on differences in regulation across the world. While we should not deny these differences and be complacent, I would like to be positive on what the G20 commitments have achieved. The key of the success of the G20 commitments is that they have driven the lawmaking by governments, and this has resulted in relatively common laws with which we have to work as securities regulators. It is clear that the financial crisis has provided the catalyst for the G20 commitments. However, we should not need a crisis to let this system work. How can we help as the international community of securities regulators to ensure that the process above runs well? We should not only cooperate after our governments have taken decisions on financial market regulation, We also should influence policy making by governments at the international level at a very early stage. And I'm very much in favor of a strong international community of securities markets regulators driving the international policy debate on financial market regulation. In popular words, we need to be ahead of the curve. We need to identify possible future areas of regulation and offer possible regulatory frameworks. For example, an area where this has worked well is CRAs, where IOSCO published its first principles in 2003, and the actual IOSCO Code of Conduct Fundamentals for Credit Rating Agencies has been largely incorporated in legislation in many countries in response to the financial crisis. The policy debates that I've just mentioned should not only be amongst colleagues, but also with various stakeholders and especially governmental representatives. IOSCO has a clear role here already, and I would like to wholeheartedly support the organization and facilitation of these policy debates by IOSCO. I am convinced that when we are successful in this area, there is a much higher chance that our governments will establish financial market regulation, which is broadly aligned. While my brief intervention here is not intended to start these policy debates and identify possible new areas of regulation, examples of important topics for the months and years ahead include shadow banking issues like money market funds and securities lending, and more intrusive regulation and supervision of financial products and their innovation. An additional argument for a more active role of securities regulators in international policy debates is that the interest in many of the current important topics are shared with other regulators, and specifically banking regulators. The latter group has strongly influenced the current regulatory reform in response to the crisis. In essence, while this is to some extent logical, considering that the crisis is in essence a banking crisis, we need to ensure that for topics that have the joint interest of banking and securities regulators, our perspective gets the right attention. In that sense, the word shadow banking is a bit misleading, because I must say that most of the areas in shadow banking are basically securities markets regulators areas. Finally, let me conclude by stating the obvious. Regulating international and interconnected financial markets from a national perspective is a mismatch. However, despite these difficult starting points, the community of international securities regulators should do its utmost to achieve broadly common regulation of international financial markets. Important ingredients to achieve this are cooperation both before and after our governments decide on the regulation of financial markets. It is essential that we drive the international policy debates on future areas of financial market regulation and possible solutions. Once regulation is in place, which is broadly similar, we need to move to a model of equivalence, mutual recognition, and cooperation between regulators. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for those remarks. ESMA is in itself an experiment and an attempt to deal with this dichotomy between the national nature of regulation and political dynamic and the international nature of the markets. I would like now to give the floor to our chairman, Mr. Bu, please.
I don't want to be a talkative person, because afterwards we are going to have a dinner. You know, I was also going to give a toast. So I'd better, you know, save time. You know, try to give just a very brief talk on this subject. It's about China's capital markets opening up and RMB convertibility in the capital accounts. First of all, I think that most important is we should notice that China have experienced a very unique path of capital market opening in the past 32 years. And secondly, I will go to talk about our, based on the real standard, you know, real ground, do some assessment of actual status of capital account convertibility in China. And the third part is about talking a little bit about advantages and the disadvantages of the Chinese path, and finally give a conclusion on the perspective for the RMB convertibility in the capital accounts. As you know, everybody knows that we started the economic reform and open door policy 32 years ago. That is China's reform and open door policy adopted that time. We have, from very beginning, the top leaders, especially Mr. Deng Xiaoping, encourages us to borrow more foreign money from the other countries and the World Bank. Actually, we borrow a lot. Now China is, have outstanding foreign debt is, roughly speaking, $700 billion. Of course, much less than our foreign exchange reserve. And we also tried very much in the portfolio investment. We welcomed something like $5 billion raised through the B-share market in the past 20 years. And we also have the QFII in the past 10 years. We have totally $26 billion. But compared with that, the FDI, foreign direct investments, is most important. That's always be a top, on the top priority of our introducing or attracting the foreign capital. That's very unique, even compared with the other developing countries, I think, with the Brazil and India and other countries. So now the totally accumulated FDI in China reached 18 trillion US dollars in the past 30 years. And it's 1.8 trillion by market cap, market value. You know, it's very big just through that. And the most important thing is to change this, not only that, because we use that foreign direct investments in China to introduce very much in China so in the state-owned enterprises reform. So that's introduced the foreign FDI in the 1980s as a joint ventures. Then we provided the chance for the restructuring of the enterprise, state-owned enterprises, even the bigger enterprises. And later on in the big banks. Also, we have introduced them as strategic investors. Can be investing in these companies and banks. So that is have a result. That means although we're not open very much in the Asia market directly to the foreign investors, except the QFII, but actually the foreign investors already become shareholder because they invested as a FDI, you know, pre-IPO and before the IPO. So that is very big. And also we can see that is, in the past 30 years, the largest the foreign direct investments come from the Hong Kong. The second largest is British Virgin Island for a long time, and the Cayman Island because they call the tax heavens or something like that. Anyway, that we can see maybe it's different from other countries, FDI, but including a lot, more and more, actually portfolio capital that come from that country as a, you know, special vehicles. And also the China concept of funds, you know. So that's make a very significant change. So that now we can see the totally foreign investors in the Asia market more than 7,500 already there, and they hold something like 2.87% of total market share. But that's not all, because we have even have more companies, you know, can be invested, the listed in the Hong Kong. So through Hong Kong, we now got more than, I guess, 400 or 500 companies listed there. Some is called H-share companies, some just called China concept companies. Of course, and several hundreds in US and in other countries. So put together, this is a very big figure. And we have something like all the listed company domestically and overseas markets together. The foreign investors, roughly speaking, hold 15% of total shares. So in that figures, you know, you can see the Chinese market, you know, is very in the share market and equity market is very much open. But it's very different because you open to the Hong Kong, you know, from the mainland, the inland is between the inland and Hong Kong is very, very much convertible. And Hong Kong is very much convertible because it's the international financial center. So that is means China mainland economy already, to some extent, very convertible. But if you use the you know, old you know, principles, old standards, that's not, because China do not allow them very much you know, foreign direct investment in the portfolio area, not in Asia directly. So our assessment is quite different with the IMF and different from the IMF and the other institutions. They say just 14, the total 40 items, because 14 items basically convertible and 22 items partly convertible, and 4 items not convertible. But in reality, our conclusion is 16 items convertible, 17 items broadly convertible, and 7 items partly convertible. No item totally inconvertible. So that is quite different. So China's RMB capital accounts convertibility actually is very high. I give the table on there. We checked each category and each items, so to 7 category and 40 items. In most case, if we buy the residence principle, maybe not convertible, but by the nationality principle, already become convertible very much. So just because the time is limited, I don't want to talk too much about that. So what is the pros and the cons of China's path? I think we have at least 5 points. It's very important. Is China pay great attention to the Greenland investment? As I mentioned, that FDI always in the top priority. That makes things very different. And also, China means all the markets, capital markets, openness, so service the real economy. That's always very important. And FDI first becomes a very good firewall against contagious financial risks, because it's not directly open the Asia markets and the other markets, including the monetary fund and other things. And also we started from the easy things to go first and making the transition very stable. And the market open starts from foreign-related economic sectors and to reduce the risk. And also for the residents and the individuals, we started with, we allowed more the individuals. They have some overseas relatives and overseas Chinese that totally put together is more than 30 million overseas Chinese and Hong Kongese, Taiwanese, and other things. So that's part because obvious advantages. But shortcomings of this approach is also can see. We see the structure of China's financial market is developed not very balancedly, partly because there's an open door policy or the special treatment. For example, now we see the banking loans still accounts for more than 60%. Sometimes in terms of incremental, it's more than 70%. So the indirect funding is dominated. And the stock, you know, the stocks and bonds, just much smaller compared with outstanding loans of the bank. And also, we see the company valuation in stock market is quite distorted. The big companies, blue chip companies, their valuation is very low, and small companies much higher, and some, you know, worst companies, so special treated companies, ST stock, you know, got more than 54 times of a PE ratio, which is very high. We also can see the investor structure is in China, so we got the natural persons. In terms of holding of the shares, they account for 27.3%. But in terms of trade volume, every day, 83.5. So all the individuals. I ask my peers from the UK, they say something like 5% is held by the individuals. And 57% is held by the enterprises, because we have a lot of state-owned enterprises and state-held enterprises. And the real mutual funds and social foundations and insurance companies put together just accounts for 15.7%. And the trade volume is 13%. So the market is, investor structure is not so rational. So the further for us, we have to face the two critical issues. How to strike a balance between safety and efficiency. I mean, when we further open the capital markets, and how to maintain the stability without losing flexibility. So finally, I got a conclusion. It's the China set up the target objective for this is in the RMB become convertibility convertible currency is in 1993. We stressed that in the 5-year plan, and now we have very good chance, I think, to carry out that strategy. The final conclusion is, I think we got 4 points is very important. The actual level of the RMB convertibility is already very high. And secondly, be careful about the concept of a fully free convertibility, because during the restructuring the international financial system, I think that we should change some concept, a basic concept, especially about fully convertibility. Because there is actually no country in reality is realize so-called fully free convertibility, because you've got a lot of things, money laundering, anti-money laundering, and terror financing, and micro prudential policy and everything. So you certainly have some supervision on the capital floating across the borders. And the third point I would stress is RMB capital accounts convertibility will not be too long from now. So it's quite likely to reach that. And finally, I think we do have to do more works. So mainly two kinds of works. The first is to sort out relevant laws and regulations based on real practice. The second is carry out assessments item by item and make it public to the international community. I think we can reach more in a common conclusions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Guo, for an overview of this impressive evolution of the Chinese market. And we must now close the session. There's a gala dinner waiting for all of us. I want us to thank our panelists for a job well done and have a good night, everyone.
Thank you, Ms. Santana. 感谢 桑塔纳女士. Ladies and gentlemen, the first panel is now closed. Please join us at the cocktail reception and gala dinner on the fourth floor. Please don't forget to leave the simultaneous interpretation receivers in the conference room. Thank you very much. 女士们, 先生们, 今天的公开论坛到此结束, 请各位来宾有序退场, 前往四层参加酒会和宴会。 请别忘了将同传耳机留在座位上，谢谢大家。